Yes, I can help. He took Charlie's other hand as well. It's just going to sleep. And when you wake up, you will wake up. Everything is going to be better. Heaven? Do you mean heaven? I don't know, Charlie. The power was very strong tonight. He could feel it flowing through their clasped hands like an electric current, and cautioned himself to be gentle. Part of him was inhabiting the faltering body that was shutting down, and the failing senses, "Hurry up, please," that were turning off. He was inhabiting a mind, "Hurry up, please, it's time," that was still as sharp as ever, and aware it was thinking its last thoughts, at least as Charlie Hayes. The bloodshot eyes closed, then opened again, very slowly. "Everything's all right," Dan said. "You only need sleep. Sleep will make you better."
"Is that what you call it?"
"Yes, I call it sleep, and it's safe to sleep."
"Don't go."
"I won't. I'm with you." So he was. It was his terrible privilege. Charlie's eyes closed again. Dan closed his own and saw a slow blue pulse in the darkness. Once. Twice. Stop. Once. Twice. Stop. Outside, the wind was blowing. "Sleep, Charlie. You're doing fine, but you're tired, and you need to sleep."
"I see my wife,"
the faintest of whispers. "Do you?"
"She says."
There was no more, just a final blue pulse behind Dan's eyes, and a final exhalation from the man on the bed. Dan opened his eyes, listened to the wind, and waited for the last thing. It came a few seconds later, a dull red mist that rose from Charlie's nose, mouth, and eyes. This was what an old nurse in Tampa, one who had about the same twinkle as Billy Freeman, called the gasp. She said she had seen it many times. Dan saw it every time. It rose and hung above the old man's body, then it faded. Dan slid up the right sleeve of Charlie's pajamas and felt for a pulse. It was just a formality. 5. As he usually left before it was over, but not tonight, he was standing on the counterpane beside Charlie's hip, staring at the door. Dan turned, expecting to see Claudette or Jan, but no one was there. Except there was. "Hello?" "Nothing." "Are you the little girl who writes on my blackboard sometimes?" No response, but someone was there, all right. "Is your name Abra?" Faint, almost inaudible because of the wind, there came a ripple of piano notes. Dan might have believed it was his imagination. He could not always tell the difference between that and The Shining, if not for Azzy, whose ears twitched and whose eyes never left the empty doorway. Someone was there, watching. "Are you Abra?" There was another ripple of notes. Then silence again, except this time it was absence. Whatever her name was, she was gone. Azzy stretched, leaped down from the bed, and left without a look back. Dan sat where he was a little longer, listening to the wind. Then he lowered the bed, pulled the sheet up over Charlie's face, and went back to the nurse's station to tell them there had been a death on the floor. 6. When his part of the paperwork was complete, Dan walked down to the snack alcove. There was a time he would have gone there on the run, fists already clenched, but those days were gone. Now he walked, taking long, slow breaths to calm his heart and mind. There was a saying in AA, "Think before you drink."
but what Casey K told him during their once-a-week tete-a-tetes was to think before he did anything.
You didn't get sober to be stupid, Danny. Keep it in mind the next time you start listening to that itty-bitty shitty committee inside your head.
But those goddamn finger marks. Carling was rocked back in his chair, now eating Junior Mints. He had swapped Popular Mechanics for a photo mag with the latest bad boy sitcom star on the cover.
Mr. Hayes has passed on, Dan said mildly.
Sorry to hear it, not looking up from the magazine. But that is what they're here for, isn't it?
Dan lifted one foot, hooked it behind one of the tilted front legs of Carling's chair, and yanked. The chair spun away and Carling landed on the floor. The box of Junior Mints flew out of his hand. He stared up at Dan unbelievingly.
Have I got your attention?
You son of a... Carling started to get up. Dan put his foot on the man's chest and pushed him back against the wall.
I see I have. Good. It would be better right now if you didn't get up. Just sit there and listen to me.
Dan bent forward and clasped his knees with his hands, tight, because all those hands wanted to do right now was hit, and hit, and hit. His temples were throbbing. Slow, he told himself. Don't let it get the better of you. But it was hard.
The next time I see your finger marks on a patient, I'll photograph them and go to Mrs. Clausen and you'll be out on the street no matter who you know. And once you're no longer a part of this institution, I'll find you and beat the living shit out of you.
Carling got to his feet, using the wall to support his back and keeping a close eye on Dan as he did it. He was taller and outweighed Dan by 100 pounds at least. He balled his fists.
I'd like to see you try. How about now?
Sure, but not here, Dan said. Too many people trying to sleep, and we've got a dead man down the hall. One with your marks on him.
I didn't do nothing but go to take his pulse. You know how easy they bruise when they got the leukemia.
I do, Dan agreed. But you hurt him on purpose. I don't know why, but I know you did.
There was a flicker in Carling's muddy eyes. Not shame. Dan didn't think the man was capable of feeling that. Just unease at being seen through and fear of being caught.
Big man, Dr. Sleep. Think your shit don't stink?
Come on, Fred. Let's go outside. More than happy to. And this was true. There was a second Dan inside. He wasn't as close to the surface anymore, but he was still there and still the same ugly, irrational son of a bitch he'd always been.
Out of the corner of his eye, Dan could see Claudette and Jan standing halfway down the hall, their eyes wide and their arms around each other.
Carling thought it over. Yes, he was bigger, and yes, he had more reach, but he was also out of shape. Too many overstuffed burritos, too many beers, much shorter wind than he'd had in his 20s, and there was something worrisome in the skinny guy's face. He'd seen it before, back in his Road Saints days. Some guys had lousy circuit breakers in their heads. They tripped easy, and once they did, those guys would burn on until they burned out. He had taken Torrance for some mousy little geek who wouldn't say shit if he had a mouthful, but he saw that he'd been wrong about that. His secret identity wasn't Dr. Sleep. He was Dr. Crazy. After considering this carefully, Fred said, I wouldn't waste my time.
Dan nodded.
Good. Save us both getting frostbite. Just remember what I said. If you don't want to go to the hospital, keep your hands to yourself from now on.
Who died and left you in charge?
I don't know, Dan said. I really don't.
7. Dan went back to his room and back to bed, but he couldn't sleep. He had made roughly 4 dozen deathbed visits during his time at Rivington House, and usually they left him calm. Not tonight. He was still trembling with rage. His conscious mind hated that red storm, but some lower part of him loved it. Probably it went back to plain old genetics, nature triumphing over nurture. The longer he stayed sober, the more old memories surfaced. Some of the clearest were of his father's rages. He had been hoping that Carling would take him up on it, would go outside into the snow and wind where Dan Torrance, son of Jack, would give that worthless puppy his medicine. God knew he didn't want to be his father, whose bouts of sobriety had been the white-knuckle kind. AA was supposed to help with anger, and mostly it did, but there were times like tonight when Dan realized what a flimsy barrier it was. Times when he felt worthless, and the booze seemed like all he deserved. At times like that, he felt very close to his father. He thought, Mama. He thought, Kenny. He thought, worthless pups need to take their medicine. And you know where they sell it, don't you? Damn near everywhere. The wind rose in a furious gust, making the turret groan. When it died, the blackboard girl was there. He could almost hear her breathing. He lifted one hand out from beneath the comforters. For a moment, it only hung there in the cold air, and then he felt hers, small, warm, slip into it. Abra, he said. Your name is Abra, but sometimes people call you Abby, isn't that right? No answer came, but he didn't really need one. All he needed was the sensation of that warm hand in his. It only lasted for a few seconds, but it was long enough to soothe him. He closed his eyes and slept. 8. 20 miles away in the little town of Anniston, Abra Stone lay awake. The hand that had enfolded hers held on for a moment or two. Then it turned to mist and was gone. But it had been there. He had been there. She had found him in a dream, but when she woke, she had discovered the dream was real. She was standing in the doorway of a room. What she had seen there was terrible and wonderful at the same time. There was death, and death was scary, but there had also been helping. The man who was helping hadn't been able to see her, but the cat had. The cat had a name like hers, but not exactly. He didn't see me, but he felt me, and we were together just now. I think I helped him, like he helped the man who died. That was a good thought. Holding on to it, as she had held the phantom hand, Abra rolled over on her side, hugged her stuffed rabbit to her chest, and went to sleep. Chapter 5. The True Knot. 1. The True Knot wasn't incorporated, but if it had been, certain side-of-the-road communities in Maine, Florida, Colorado, and New Mexico would have been referred to as company towns. These were places where all the major businesses and large plots of land could be traced back through a tangle of holding companies to them. The True's towns, with colorful names like Dry Bend, Jerusalem's Lot, Ori, and Sidewinder, were safe havens, but they never stayed in those places for long. Mostly they were migratory. If you drive the turnpikes and main-traveled highways of America, you may have seen them. Maybe it was on I-95 in South Carolina, somewhere south of Dillon and north of Santee. Maybe it was on I-80 in Nevada, in the mountain country west of Draper, or in Georgia, while negotiating slowly, if you know what's good for you, that notorious Highway 41 speed trap outside Tifton. How many times have you found yourself behind a lumbering RV, eating exhaust and waiting impatiently for your chance to pass? Creeping along at 40 when you could be doing a perfectly legal 65 or even 70? And when there's finally a hole in the fast lane and you pull out, holy God, you see a long line of those damn things. Gas hogs driven at exactly 10 miles an hour below the legal speed limit, by bespectacled golden oldies who hunch over their steering wheels, gripping them like they think they're going to fly away. Or maybe you've encountered them in the turnpike rest areas when you stop to stretch your legs and maybe drop a few quarters into one of the vending machines. The entrance ramps to those rest stops always divide in two, don't they? Cars in one parking lot, long-haul trucks and RVs in another. Usually the lot for the big rigs and RVs is a little farther away. You might have seen the Trues rolling motorhomes parked in that lot, all in a cluster. You might have seen their owners walking up to the main building, slow because many of them look old and some of them are pretty darn fat, always in a group, always keeping to themselves. Sometimes they pull off at one of the exits loaded with gas stations, motels, and fast food joints. And if you see those RVs parked at McDonald's or Burger King, you keep on going because you know they'll all be lined up at the counter. The men wearing floppy golf hats or long-billed fishing caps. The women in stretch pants, usually powder blue, and shirts that say things like, "Ask me about my grandchildren," or "Jesus is King," or "Happy Wanderer." You'd rather go half a mile farther down the road to the Waffle House or Shoney's, wouldn't you? Because you know they'll take forever to order, mooning over the menu, always wanting their quarter pounders without the pickles or their Whoppers without the sauce, asking if there are any interesting tourist attractions in the area, even though anyone can see this is just another nothing three-stoplight burg where the kids leave as soon as they graduate from the nearest high school. You hardly see them, right? Why would you? They're just the RV people, elderly, retirees, and a few younger compatriots living their rootless lives on the turnpikes and blue highways, staying at campgrounds where they sit around in their Walmart lawn chairs and cook on their hibachis while they talk about investments and fishing tournaments and hot pot recipes and God knows what. They're the ones who always stop at flea markets and yard sales, parking their damn dinosaurs nose to tail half on the shoulder and half on the road, so you have to slow to a crawl in order to creep by. They are the opposite of the motorcycle clubs you sometimes see on those same turnpikes and blue highways, the mild angels instead of the wild ones. They're annoying as hell when they descend en masse on a rest area and fill up all the toilets, but once their balky, road-stunned bowels finally work and you're able to take a pew yourself, you put them out of your mind, don't you? They're no more remarkable than a flock of birds on a telephone wire or a herd of cows grazing in a field beside the road. Oh, you might wonder how they can afford to fill those fuel-guzzling monstrosities. Because they must be on comfy fixed incomes, how else could they spend all their time driving around like they do? And you might puzzle over why anyone would want to spend their golden years cruising all those endless American miles between hoot and holler, but beyond that, you probably never spare them a thought. And if you happen to be one of those unfortunate people who's ever lost a kid, nothing left but a bike in the vacant lot down the street or a little cap lying in the bushes at the edge of a nearby stream, you probably never thought of them. Why would you? No, it was probably some hobo. Or, worse to consider but horribly plausible, some sick fuck from your very own town. Maybe your very own neighborhood. Maybe even your very own street. Some sick killer pervo who's very good at looking normal and will go on looking normal until someone finds a clatter of bones in the guy's basement or buried in his backyard. You'd never think of the RV people, those midlife pensioners and cheery older folks in their golf hats and sun visors with appliqued flowers on them. And mostly you'd be right. There are thousands of RV people, but by 2011, there was only one knot left in America. The true knot. They liked moving around, and that was good because they had to. If they stayed in one place, they'd eventually attract attention because they don't age like other people. Apron Annie, or Dirty Phil, Rube names Anne Lamont and Phil Caputo, might appear to grow 20 years older overnight. The little twins, P and Pod, might snap back from 22 to 12, or almost, the age at which they turned, but their turning was long ago. The only member of the True who's actually young is Andrea Steiner, now known as Snakebite Andy, and even she's not as young as she looks. A tottery, grumpy old lady of 80 suddenly becomes 60 again. A leathery old gent of 70 is able to put away his cane. The skin tumors on his arms and face disappear. Black-eyed Susie loses her hitching limp. Diesel Doug goes from half-blind with cataracts to sharp-eyed, his bald spot magically gone. All at once, hey presto, he's 45 again. Steamhead Steve's crooked back straightens. His wife, Baba the Red, ditches those uncomfortable continence pants, puts on her rhinestone-studded Ariat boots, and says she wants to go out line dancing. Given time to observe such changes, people would wonder and people would talk. Eventually some reporter would turn up, and the true knot shied away from publicity the way vampires supposedly shy away from sunlight. But since they don't live in one place, and when they stop for an extended period in one of their company towns they keep to themselves, they fit right in. Why not? They wear the same clothes as the other RV people. They wear the same El Cheapo sunglasses, they buy the same souvenir T-shirts, and consult the same AAA roadmaps. They put the same decals on their Bounders and Bagos, touting all the peculiar places they visited. I helped trim the world's biggest tree in Christmasland. And you find yourself looking at the same bumper stickers while you're stuck behind them. Old but not dead. Save Medicare. I'm a conservative and I vote, waiting for a chance to pass. They eat fried chicken from the Colonel and buy the occasional scratch ticket in those easy-on, easy-off convenience stores where they sell beer, bait, ammo, Motor Trend magazine, and 10,000 kinds of candy bars. If there's a bingo hall in the town where they stop, a bunch of them are apt to go on over, take a table, and play until the last coverall game is finished. At one of those games, Greedy G, Rube named Greta Moore, won $500. She gloated over that for months, and although the members of the True have all the money they need, it pissed off some of the other ladies to no end. Token Charlie wasn't too pleased either. He said he'd been waiting on B7 for 5 pulls from the hopper when the G finally bingoed. Greedy, you're one lucky bitch, he said.
And you're one unlucky bastard, she replied. One unlucky black bastard,
and went off chortling. If one of them happens to get speed-trapped or stopped for some minor traffic offense, it's rare, but it does happen. The cops find nothing but valid licenses, up-to-date insurance cards, and paperwork in apple pie order. No voices are raised while the cop's standing there with his citation book, even if it's an obvious scam. The charges are never disputed, and all fines are paid promptly. America is a living body. The highways are its arteries, and the true knot slips along them like a silent virus. But there are no dogs. Ordinary RV people travel with lots of canine company, usually those little shit machines with white fur, gaudy collars, and nasty tempers. You know the kind. They have irritating barks that hurt your ears and ratty little eyes full of disturbing intelligence. You see them sniffing their way through the grass in the designated pet walking areas of the turnpike rest stops, their owners trailing behind, pooper scoopers at the ready. In addition to the usual decals and bumper stickers on the motorhomes of these ordinary RV people, you're apt to see yellow diamond-shaped signs reading Pomeranian on board or I heart my poodle. Not the true knot. They don't like dogs, and dogs don't like them. You might say dogs see through them, to the sharp and watchful eyes behind the cut-rate sunglasses, to the strong and long-muscled hunter's legs beneath the polyester slacks from Walmart, to the sharp teeth beneath the dentures, waiting to come out. They don't like dogs, but they like certain children. Oh, yes, they like certain children very much. 2. In May of 2011, Not long after Abra Stone celebrated her 10th birthday and Dan Torrance his 10th year of AA sobriety, Crow Daddy knocked on the door of Rosie the Hat's Earth Cruiser. The True was currently staying at the cozy campground outside Lexington, Kentucky. They were on their way to Colorado, where they would spend most of the summer in one of their bespoke towns, this one a place Dan sometimes revisited in his dreams. Usually, they were in no hurry to get anywhere, but there was some urgency this summer. All of them knew it, but none of them talked about it. Rose would take care of it. She always had. "Come," she said, and Crow Daddy stepped in. When on a business errand, he always stepped out in good suits and expensive shoes polished to a mirror gloss. If he was feeling particularly old school, he might even carry a walking stick. This morning, he was wearing baggy pants held up by suspenders, a strappy T-shirt with a fish on it, "Kiss My Bass," printed beneath, and a flat workman's cap, which he swept off as he closed the door behind him. He was her sometime lover, as well as her second in command, but he never failed to show respect. It was one of the many things Rose liked about him. She had no doubt that the True could carry on under his leadership if she died. For a while, at least. But for another 100 years? Perhaps not. Probably not. He had a silver tongue and cleaned up well when he had to deal with the rubes, but Crow had only rudimentary planning skills and no real vision. This morning he looked troubled. Rose was sitting on the sofa in capri pants and a plain white bra, smoking a cigarette and watching the third hour of Today on her big wall-mounted TV. That was the soft hour when they featured celebrity chefs and actors doing PR for their new movies. Her top hat was cocked back on her head. Crow Daddy had known her for more years than the rubes lived, and he still didn't know what magic held it at that gravity-defying angle. She picked up the remote and muted the sound. "Why, it's Henry Rothman, as I live and breathe. Looking remarkably tasty, too, although I doubt you came to be tasted. Not at 10:15 in the morning, and not with that look on your face. Who died?" She meant it as a joke, but the wincing frown that tightened his forehead told her it wasn't one. She turned the TV off and made a business of butting her cigarette, not wanting him to see the dismay she felt. Once, the True had been over 200 strong. As of yesterday, they numbered 41. If she was right about the meaning of that wince, they were one less today.
"Tommy the truck," he said. "Went in his sleep. Cycled once and then boom. Didn't suffer at all, which is fucking rare, as you know."
"Did not see him." While he was still there to be seen, she thought, but did not add.
Walnut, whose Rube driver's license and various Rube credit cards identified him as Peter Wallace of Little Rock, Arkansas, was the True's sawbones. "No, it was too quick. Heavy Mary was with him. Tommy woke her up thrashing. She thought it was a bad dream and gave him an elbow. Only by then there was nothing left to poke but his pajamas. It was probably a heart attack. Tommy had a bad cold. Nut thinks that might have been a contributing factor. And you know the son of a bitch always smoked like a chimney."
"We don't get heart attacks." Then reluctantly, "Of course we usually don't get colds either. He was really wheezing the last few days, wasn't he? Poor old T.T."
"Yeah, poor old T.T. Nut says it'd be impossible to tell anything for sure without an autopsy." "Which couldn't happen. By now there would be no body left to cut up."
"How's Mary taking it?"
"How do you think? She's broken fucking hearted. They go back to when Tommy the truck was Tommy the wagon. Almost 90 years. She was the one who took care of him after he turned. Gave him his first steam when he woke up the next day. Now she says she wants to kill herself."
Rose was rarely shocked, but this did the job. No one in the true had ever killed themselves. Life was, to coin a phrase, their only reason for living.
"Probably just talk," Crodaddy said. "Only..."
"Only what?"
"You're right about us not usually getting colds, but there have been quite a few just lately. Mostly just sniffles that come and go. Nut says it may be malnutrition. Of course, he's just guessing."
Rose sat in thought, tapping her fingers against her bare midriff and staring at the blank rectangle of the TV. At last, she said, "Okay, I agree that nourishment's been a bit thin lately, but we took steam in Delaware just a month ago, and Tommy was fine then. Plumped right up."
"Yeah, but Rosie, the kid from Delaware wasn't much. More hunchhead than steamhead."
She'd never thought of it just that way, but it was true. Also, he'd been 19, according to his driver's license. Well past whatever stunted prime he might have had around puberty. In another 10 years, he'd have been just another rube. Maybe even 5. He hadn't been much of a meal, point taken.
"But you couldn't always have steak. Sometimes you had to settle for bean sprouts and tofu. At least they kept body and soul together until you could butcher the next cow. Except psychic tofu and bean sprouts hadn't kept Tommy the truck's body and soul together, had they?"
"There used to be more steam," Crow said.
"Don't be daft. That's like the rube saying that 50 years ago people were more neighborly. It's a myth, and I don't want you spreading it around. People are nervous enough already."
"You know me better than that. And I don't think it is a myth, darling. If you think about it, it stands to reason. 50 years ago, there was more of everything. Oil, wildlife, arable land, clean air. There were even a few honest politicians."
"Yes," Rose cried. "Richard Nixon, remember him? Prince of the Rubes?"
But he wouldn't go chasing up this false trail. Crow might be a bit lacking in the vision department, but he was rarely distracted. That was why he was her second.
He might even have a point. Who was to say that humans capable of providing the nourishment the true needed weren't dwindling just like schools of tuna in the Pacific?
"You better bust open one of the canisters, Rosie."
He saw her eyes widen and raised a hand to stop her from speaking.
"Nobody's saying that out loud, but the whole family's thinking about it."
Rose had no doubt they were. And the idea that Tommy had died of complications resulting from malnutrition had a certain horrid plausibility. When steam was in short supply, life grew hard and lost its savor. They weren't vampires from one of those old Hammer horror pictures, but they still needed to eat.
"And how long since we've had a 7th wave?"
Crow asked. He knew the answer to that, and so did she. The true knot had limited precognitive skills, but when a truly big rube disaster was approaching, a 7th wave, they all felt it. Although the details of the attack on the World Trade Center had only begun to clarify for them in the late summer of 2001, they had known something was going to happen in New York City for months in advance. She could still remember the joy and anticipation. She supposed hungry rubes felt the same way when they smelled a particularly savory meal cooking in the kitchen. There had been plenty for everybody that day, and in the days following. There might only have been a couple of true steamheads among those who died when the towers fell. But when the disaster was big enough, agony and violent death had an enriching quality. Which was why the true was drawn to such sights, like insects to a bright light. Locating single rube steamheads was far more difficult, and there were only 3 of them now with that specialized sonar in their heads. Grandpa Flick, Barry the Chink, and Rose herself. She got up, grabbed a neatly folded boat-neck top from the counter and pulled it over her head. As always, she looked gorgeous in a way that was a bit unearthly, those high cheekbones and slightly tipped eyes, but extremely sexy. She put her hat back on and gave it a tap for good luck.
How many full canisters do you think are left, Crow?
He shrugged. A dozen? 15?
In that neighborhood?
She agreed. Better that none of them knew the truth, not even her second. The last thing she needed was for the current unease to become outright panic. When people panicked, they ran in all directions.
If that happened, the true might disintegrate.
Meanwhile, Crow was looking at her, and closely, before he could see too much, she said,
"Can you four-wall this place tonight?"
"You kidding? With the price of gas and diesel what it is, the guy who owns it can't fill half his spots even on weekends. He'll jump at the chance."
"Then do it. We're going to take canister steam. Spread the word."
"You've got it."
He kissed her, caressing one of her breasts as he did so.
"This is my favorite top."
She laughed and pushed him away.
"Any top with tits in it is your favorite top. Go on."
But he lingered, a grin tipping one corner of his mouth.
"Is Rattlesnake Girl still sniffing around your door, beautiful?"
She reached down and briefly squeezed him below the belt.
"Oh my gosh, is that your jealous bone I'm feeling?"
"Say it is."
She doubted it, but was flattered anyway.
"She's with Sayri now, and the two of them are perfectly happy. But since we're on the subject of Andy, she can help us. You know how. Spread the word, but speak to her first."
After he left, she locked the Earth Cruiser, went to the cockpit, and dropped to her knees. She worked her fingers into the carpet between the driver's seat and the control pedals. A strip of it came up. Beneath was a square of metal with an embedded keypad. Rose ran the numbers, and the safe popped open an inch or two. She lifted the door the rest of the way and looked inside.
15 or a dozen full canisters left. That had been Crow's guess, and although she couldn't read members of the tribe the way she could read the Rubes, Rose was sure he had been purposely lowballing to cheer her up. "If he only knew," she thought.
The safe was lined with styrofoam to protect the canisters in case of a road accident, and there were 40 built-in cradles. On this fine May morning in Kentucky, 37 of the canisters in those cradles were empty. Rose took one of the remaining full ones and held it up. It was light. If you hefted it, you would have guessed it too was empty. She took the cap off, inspected the valve beneath to make sure the seal was still intact, then reclosed the safe and put the canister carefully, almost reverently, on the counter where her top had been folded. After tonight, there would only be two. They had to find some big steam and refill at least a few of those empty canisters, and they had to do it soon. The true's back wasn't to the wall, not quite yet, but it was only inches away.
3.
The cozy campground owner and his wife had their own trailer, a permanent job set up on painted concrete blocks. April showers had brought lots of May flowers, and Mr. and Mrs. Cozy's front yard was full of them. Andrea Steiner paused a moment to admire the tulips and pansies before mounting the 3 steps to the door of the big Redmond trailer, where she knocked. Mr. Cozy opened up eventually. He was a small man, with a big belly, currently encased in a bright red strappy undershirt. In one hand he held a can of Pabst Blue Ribbon. In the other was a mustard-smeared brat wrapped in a slice of spongy white bread. Because his wife was currently in the other room, he paused for a moment to do a visual inventory of the young woman before him, ponytail to sneakers. "Yeah?" Several in the tribe had a bit of sleeper talent, but Andy was by far the best, and her turning had proved of enormous benefit to the true. She still used the ability on occasion to lift cash from the wallets of certain older Rube gentlemen who were attracted to her. Rose found this risky and childish, but knew from experience that in time, what Andy called her issues would fade away. For the true knot, the only issue was survival.
I just had a quick question,
Andy said. If it's about the toilets, darling, the cockasucker don't come until Thursday.
It's not about that.
What then?
Aren't you tired? Don't you want to go to sleep?
Mr. Cozy immediately closed his eyes. The beer and the brat tumbled out of his hands, leaving a mess on the rug.
Oh, well, Andy thought. Crow fronted the guy 1,200. Mr. Cozy can afford a bottle of carpet cleaner, maybe even two.
Andy took him by the arm and led him into the living room. Here was a pair of chintz-covered cozy armchairs with TV trays set up in front of them.
Sit,
she said. Mr. Cozy sat, eyes shut.
You like to mess with young girls?
Andy asked him.
You would if you could, wouldn't you? If you could run fast enough to catch them anyway.
She surveyed him, hands on hips.
You're disgusting. Can you say that?
I'm disgusting,
Mr. Cozy agreed. Then he began to snore. Mrs. Cozy came in from the kitchen. She was gnawing on an ice cream sandwich.
Here now, who are you? What are you telling him? What do you want?
For you to sleep,
Andy told her. Mrs. Cozy dropped her ice cream. Then her knees unhinged and she sat on it.
Ah, fuck, Andy said. I didn't mean there. Get up.
Mrs. Cozy got up with the squashed ice cream sandwich sticking to the back of her dress. Snakebite Andy put her arm around the woman's mostly non-existent waist and led her to the other cozy chair, pausing long enough to pull the melting ice cream sandwich off her butt. Soon the two of them sat side by side, eyes shut.
You'll sleep all night, Andy instructed them. Mister can dream about chasing young girls. Missus, you can dream he died of a heart attack and left you a $1 million insurance policy. How's that sound? Sound good?
She snapped on the TV and turned it up loud. Pat Sajak was being embraced by a woman with enormous jahoobies who had just finished solving the puzzle, which was, Never rest on your laurels.
Andy took a moment to admire the mammoth mammaries, then turned back to the cozies. When the 11 o'clock news is over, you can turn off the TV and go to bed. When you wake up tomorrow, you won't remember I was here. Any questions?
They had none. Andy left them and hurried back to the cluster of RVs.
She was hungry, had been for weeks, and tonight there would be plenty for everybody. As for tomorrow, it was Rosa's job to worry about that. And as far as Snakebite Andy was concerned, she was welcome to it.
4. It was full dark by 8 o'clock. At 9, the crew gathered in the cozy campground's picnic area. Rose the Hat came last, carrying the canister. A small, greedy murmur went up at the sight of it. Rose knew how they felt. She was plenty hungry herself. She mounted one of the initial scarred picnic tables and looked at them one by one.
We are the True Knot.
We are the True Knot,
they responded. Their faces were solemn, their eyes avid and hungry.
What is tied may never be untied.
We are the True Knot, and we endure.
We endure.
We are the chosen ones. We are the fortunate ones.
We are chosen and fortunate.
They are the makers. We are the takers.
We take what they make.
Take this and use it well.
We will use it well.
Once, early in the last decade of the 20th century, there had been a boy from Enid, Oklahoma, named Richard Galesworthy.
I swear that child can read my mind, his mother sometimes said.
People smiled at this, but she wasn't kidding. And maybe not just her mind. Richard got A's on tests he hadn't even studied for. He knew when his father was going to come home in a good mood and when he was going to come home fuming about something at the plumbing supply company he owned. Once, the boy begged his mother to play the pick six lottery because he swore he knew the winning numbers. Mrs. Galesworthy refused. They were good Baptists. But later she was sorry. Not all six of the numbers Richard wrote down on the kitchen note-minder board came up, but five did. Her religious convictions had cost them $70,000. She had begged the boy not to tell his father, and Richard had promised he wouldn't. He was a good boy. A lovely boy. 2 months or so after the lottery win that wasn't,
Mrs. Galesworthy was shot to death in her kitchen, and the good and lovely boy disappeared. His body had long since rotted away beneath the gone-to-seed back field of an abandoned farm. But when Rose the Hat opened the valve on the silver canister, his essence, his steam, escaped in a cloud of sparkling silver mist. It rose to a height of about 3 feet above the canister and spread out in a plain. The crew stood looking up at it with expectant faces. Most were trembling. Several were actually weeping. "Take nourishment and endure," Rose said, and raised her hands until her spread fingers were just below the flat plain of mist. She beckoned. The mist immediately began to sink, taking on an umbrella shape as it descended toward those waiting below. When it enveloped their heads, they began to breathe deeply. This went on for 5 minutes, during which several of them hyperventilated and swooned to the ground. Rose felt herself swelling physically and sharpening mentally. Every fragrant odor of the spring night declared itself. She knew that the faint lines around her eyes and mouth were disappearing. The white strands in her hair were turning dark again. Later tonight, Crow would come to her camper, and in her bed they would burn like torches. They inhaled Richard Galesworthy until he was gone, really and truly gone. The white mist thinned and then disappeared. Those who had fainted sat up and looked around, smiling. Grandpa Flick grabbed Petty the Chink, Barry's wife, and did a nimble little jig with her. "Let go of me, you old donkey," she snapped, but she was laughing. Snakebite Andy and Silent Sari were kissing deeply. Andy's hands plunged into Sari's mouse-colored hair. Rose leaped down from the picnic table and turned to Crow. He made a circle with his thumb and forefinger, grinning back at her. "Everything's cool," that grin said, and so it was. For now. But in spite of her euphoria, Rose thought of the canisters in her safe. Now there were 38 empties instead of 37. Their backs were a step closer to the wall. 5. The True rolled out the next morning just after first light. They took Route 12 to I-64, the 14 RVs and a nose-to-tail caravan. When they reached the interstate, they would spread out so they weren't quite so obviously together, staying in touch by radio in case trouble arose. Or if opportunity knocked. Ernie and Maureen Salkowicz, fresh from a wonderful night's sleep, agreed those RV folks were just about the best they'd ever had. Not only did they pay cash and bus up their sights neat as a pin, someone left an apple bread pudding on the top step of their trailer with a sweet thank you note on top. With any luck, the Salkowiczes told each other as they ate their gift dessert for breakfast, they'd come back next year. "Do you know what?" Maureen said. "I dreamed that lady on the insurance commercials, Flo, sold you a big insurance policy. Wasn't that a crazy dream?" Ernie grunted and splooshed more whipped cream onto his bread pudding. "Did you dream, honey?" "Nope." But his eyes slid away from hers as he said it. 6. The True Knot's luck turned for the better on a hot July day in Iowa. Rose was leading the caravan, as she always did, and just west of Adair, the sonar in her head gave a ping. Not a head blaster by any means, but moderately loud. She hopped on the CB at once to Barry the Chink, who was about as Asian as Tom Cruise.
"Barry, did you feel that? Come back."
"Yeah?"
Barry was not the garrulous type.
"Who's Grandpa Flick riding with today?"
Before Barry could answer, there was a double break on the CB, and Apron Annie said,
"He's with me in Long Paul, sweetie. Is it a good one?"
Annie sounded anxious, and Rose could understand that. Richard Galesworthy had been a very good one, but 6 weeks was a long time between meals, and he was beginning to wear off.
"Is the old feller compass, Annie?"
Before she could answer, a raspy voice came back.
"I'm fine, woman."
And for a guy who sometimes couldn't remember his own name, Grandpa Flick did sound pretty much okay. Testy, sure, but testy was a lot better than befuddled. A second ping hit her, this one not as strong, as if to underline a point that needed no underlining. Grandpa said,
"We're going the wrong fucking way."
Rose didn't bother answering, just clicked another double break on her mic.
"Crow, come back, honey bunch."
"I'm here,"
prompt as always, just waiting to be called.
"Pull 'em in at the next rest area. Except for me, Barry, and Flick. We'll take the next exit and double back."
"Will you need a crew?"
"I won't know until we get closer, but I don't think so."
"Okay."
A pause, then he added,
"Shit."
Rose racked the mic and looked out at the unending acres of corn on both sides of the four-lane.
Crow was disappointed, of course. They all would be.
Big steamheads presented problems because they were all but immune to suggestion. That meant taking them by force. Friends or family members often tried to interfere. They could sometimes be put to sleep, but not always. A kid with big steam could block even Snakebite Andy's best efforts in that regard. So sometimes people had to be killed. Not good, but the prize was always worth it. Life and strength stored away in a steel canister. Stored for a rainy day. In many cases, there was even a residual benefit. Steam was hereditary, and often everyone in the target's family had at least a little.
7.
While most of the True Knot waited in a pleasantly shady rest area 40 miles east of Council Bluffs, the RVs containing the three finders turned around, left the turnpike at Adair, and headed north. Once away from I-80 and out in the Tulies, they spread apart and began working the grid of graveled, well-maintained farm roads that parceled this part of Iowa into big squares. Moving in on the ping from different directions. Triangulating. It got stronger. A little stronger still. Then leveled off. Good steam, but not great steam.
Ah, well.
Beggars couldn't be choosers. 8. Bradley Trevor had been given the day off from his usual farm chores to practice with the local Little League All-Star team. If his pa had refused him this, the coach probably would have led the rest of the boys in a lynch party because Brad was the team's best hitter. You wouldn't think it to look at him. He was skinny as a rake candle, and only 11. But he was able to tag even the district's best pitchers for singles and doubles. The meatballers he almost always took deep. Some of it was plain farm boy's strength, but by no means all of it. Brad just seemed to know what pitch was coming next. It wasn't a case of stealing signs, a possibility upon which some of the other district coaches had speculated darkly. He just knew. The way he knew the best location for a new stock well. Or where the occasional lost cow had gotten off to. Or where Ma's engagement ring was the time she'd lost it. "Look under the floor mat of the Suburban," he'd said, and there it was. That day's practice was an especially good one, but Brad seemed lost in the ozone during the debriefing afterward and declined to take a soda from the tub filled with ice when it was offered. He said he thought he'd better get home and help his Ma take in the clothes. "Is it gonna rain?" Micah Johnson, the coach, asked. They'd all come to trust him on such things.
"Dunno," Brad said listlessly.
"You feel okay, son? You look a little peaked."
In fact, Brad didn't feel well. Had gotten up that morning headachy and a bit feverish. That wasn't why he wanted to go home now, though. He just had a strong sense that he no longer wanted to be at the baseball field. His mind didn't seem quite his own. He wasn't sure if he was here or only dreaming he was. How crazy was that? He scratched absently at a red spot on his forearm. "Same time tomorrow, right?"
Coach Johnson said that was the plan, and Brad walked off with his glove trailing from one hand. Usually he jogged, they all did, but today he didn't feel like it. His head still ached, and now his legs did, too.
He disappeared into the corn behind the bleachers, meaning to take a shortcut back to the farm 2 miles away. When he emerged onto Town Road D, brushing silk from his hair with a slow and dreamy hand,
A mid-sized Wander King was idling on the gravel. Standing beside it, smiling, was Barry the Chink.
"Well, there you are," Barry said.
"Who are you?"
"A friend. Hop in. I'll take you home."
"Sure," Brad said. Feeling the way he did, a ride would be fine. He scratched at the red spot on his arm. "You're Barry Smith. You're a friend. I'll hop in and you'll take me home." He stepped into the RV. The door closed. The Wander King drove away. By the next day, the whole county would be mobilized in a hunt for the Adair All-Star center fielder and best hitter. A state police spokesman asked residents to report any strange cars or vans. There were many such reports, but they all came to nothing. And although the three RVs carrying the finders were much bigger than vans and Rose the Hats was truly huge, nobody reported them. They were the RV people, after all, and traveling together. Brad was just gone. Like thousands of other unfortunate children, he had been swallowed up, seemingly in a single bite. 9. They took him north to an abandoned ethanol processing plant that was miles from the nearest farmhouse. Crow carried the boy out of Rose's earth cruiser and laid him gently on the ground. Brad was bound with duct tape and weeping. As the true knot gathered around him, like mourners over an open grave, he said, "Please take me home. I'll never tell." Rose dropped to one knee beside him and sighed.
"I would if I could, son, but I can't."
His eyes found Barry.
"You said you were one of the good guys. I heard you. You said so."
"Sorry, pal." Barry didn't look sorry. What he looked was hungry. "It's not personal."
Brad shifted his eyes back to Rose.
"Are you going to hurt me? Please don't hurt me."
Of course they were going to hurt him. It was regrettable, but pain purified steam, and the true had to eat. Lobsters also felt pain when they were dropped into pots of boiling water, but that didn't stop the rubes from doing it. Food was food, and survival was survival. Rose put her hands behind her back. Into one of these, Greedy G placed a knife. It was short but very sharp. Rose smiled down at the boy and said, "As little as possible." The boy lasted a long time. He screamed until his vocal cords ruptured and his cries became husky barks. At one point, Rose paused and looked around. Her hands, long and strong, wore bloody red gloves.
"Something?" Crow asked.
"We'll talk later," Rose said, and went back to work. The light of a dozen flashlights had turned a piece of ground behind the ethanol plant into a makeshift operating theater. Brad Trevor whispered, "Please kill me." Rose the Hat gave him a comforting smile.
"Soon."
But it wasn't. Those husky barks recommenced, and eventually they turned to steam. At dawn, they buried the boy's body, and then they moved on. Chapter 6. Weird Radio. 1. It hadn't happened in at least 3 years, but some things you don't forget. Like when your child begins screaming in the middle of the night. Lucy was on her own because David was attending a 2-day conference in Boston, but she knew if he'd been there, he would have raced her down the hall to Abra's room. He hadn't forgotten either. Their daughter was sitting up in bed, her face pale, her hair standing out in a sleep scruff all around her head, her eyes wide and staring blankly into space. The sheet, all she needed to sleep under during warm weather, had been pulled free and was balled up around her like a crazy cocoon. Lucy sat beside her and put an arm around Abra's shoulders. It was like hugging stone. This was the worst part, before she came all the way out of it. Being ripped from sleep by your daughter's screams was terrifying, but the non-responsiveness was worse. Between the ages of 5 and 7, these night terrors had been fairly common, and Lucy was always afraid that sooner or later the child's mind would break under the strain. She would continue to breathe, but her eyes would never unlock from whatever world it was that she saw and they couldn't.